It's 7:30 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. Noted fiddler Jake Crack likes to take his class to a special place.
I'm teaching a dance fiddle class this week. Our last day, I always take the class out for a little field trip. And so we're having class up at the Big Spruce Overlook here on Black Mountain. Kind of appreciate nature and learn our last tune and review everything we've done for the week.
The story coming up on this West Virginia morning. Ginseng annually brings millions of dollars in revenue into Appalachia, but its future as a revenue option or even its existence at all in these parts is far from certain. Growers are struggling to conserve the plant and ensure the vitality of the industry. Those concerns, as well as new research that sheds light on the therapeutic qualities of the plant, were discussed at the 2014 Ginseng Summit. A small gathering of key stakeholders in the ginseng industry gathered at the Golden Seal Botanical Sanctuary just outside the small town of Rutland in Meigs County, Ohio, to discuss important topics surrounding the medicinal root. Glynis Board reports.
About 35 gathered, producers, buyers, government enforcement agents, and academics, to discuss relevant topics within the ginseng industry. United Plant Savers hosted the summit. Susan Leopold is the Medicinal Native Plant Conservation Group's executive director.
Everyone shares the same passion, which is to have ginseng be a part of our forest economy for generations to come.
The last Ginseng Summit occurred in 2008, when these various industry players met to discuss the issues they collectively face.
An early stage of something that may grow into something that's recognized to be a valid program, much like USDA certified organic. And we all know that not everybody...
That's Eric Burkhart, one of the organizers of the Ginseng Summit, addressing the group. He's an academic from Penn State University who's been researching ginseng, the culture, the industry, and the science thereof for over a decade.
There's a lot of growers, forest-based growers here, and there are a lot of issues that these growers face as they're trying to operate within what has traditionally been a wild harvested kind of industry. And so they are dealing with a bunch of issues such as poaching and lack of genetic stock and lack of institutional support or institutional alignment in terms of how they process paperwork and so on.
Demand for ginseng root in Asian markets has fueled the ginseng industry since the 1700s, when the plant was discovered in North America. Since then, an ever-increasing demand has landed the plant on a list of endangered species, alongside things like ivory and shark and mahogany, species that are carefully monitored to ensure that international trade doesn't threaten their survival. But Burkhart says there's very little awareness in this country that the ginseng industry even exists in North America, let alone the threats it faces.
So, for example, everybody understands that there is a maple syrup industry that operates on forest lands, and that group of stakeholders, maple syrup producers, have worked very well with agricultural colleges and forestry schools and that sort of stuff to develop robust programs, not only around research, but around economics and branding and the appropriate involvement of departments of agriculture and that sort of stuff. And we haven't experienced that with ginseng. Ginseng is still considered very much a fringe product in most states where it's exported from. There's really no structure or awareness built around this industry. And so growers are still struggling with very basic things like the ability to harvest their crop whenever they deem it appropriate versus being bound to regulations designed for wild harvesters.
Current regulations are designed to safeguard the plant's existence in the wild. You can't harvest a plant that's younger than 5 years old. You can't harvest except when the berries are ripe and ready themselves to be planted. You have to have all your roots certified with approved dealers. And the rules vary from state to state. In the world today, the highest priced ginseng is root that grows naturally or plants that have been grown in natural settings. Holly Chittum, a researcher from Maryland University's Integrative Health Department, has done a lot of work researching forest-grown medicinal plants.
When we talk about wild and wild simulated ginseng, it's all about an export market at this point. Mm-hmm. And that's because they're really hard to grow and it takes a long time. And they're the ones that are willing to pay the money that would actually pay the growers back for, mm-hmm. That time investment.
But Chittum is hopeful that a more robust market will develop in this country. She explains in Western or allopathic medicine, the herb is considered an adaptogen, meaning it modulates functions in the human system like hormones and immune responses. In fact, she herself uses ginseng intermediately in her own personal health maintenance routine.
The theory is, and there's a lot of research behind it that really supports it, is that it actually helps your body to just deal better with the stress response on a cellular level. Mm-hmm. So that you have more energy, but you also sleep better. You know, it's also helps to level your mood out, that sort of thing. And with immune response, I think that's kind of the easiest way to show the adaptogenic effect is that if your immune is working, you know, too hard, too much, then it would kind of modulate it and bring it down. And if your immune system needs a boost, it would bring it up.
Well, that sort of sounds like magic.
It seems like that to us. That's not how we think of medicine, right? We think of it acting on our body and changing our body's chemistry. Like the medicine is what does something. Well, in this case, the medicine is actually nudging our body to do its own work, to do what it needs to do on its own. It's big medicine here in the States, and it's especially big medicine in China. It's, you know, been used there for, they say, 4,000 years, you know.
Another summit attendee discussing therapeutic research findings was Marla McIntosh, a professor at the University of Maryland at College Park. She studies the genetics of American ginseng.
I became interested in ginseng because it's a non-timber product of forests. And since I have always worked in forestry, it's a high priority to give landowners a reason to keep their forests in forests rather than develop them and have some type of income that does not depend on harvesting the trees.
Studying and comparing ginseng populations that span various geographical regions throughout the country, McIntosh was able to determine genetically different variations of the plants. And among those differences, she found various combinations and levels of the bioactive components called ginsenosides from region to region.
And this is very important because the different ginsenosides have different modes of action. And for example, some ginsenosides are known to promote cell growth and would help in heart diseases, whereas others are known to inhibit growth, and these would be helpful for applications in cancer therapy.
McIntosh says given the genetic testing procedures and technologies available today, conservation efforts need to be aimed at preserving not simply the plant, but also the genetically diverse populations which stand to benefit us in ways we've only just begun to understand. It's an overriding sentiment at the summit, echoed by Susan Leopold, executive director of United Plant Savers, who hosted the event. She says the goals of the summit are twofold.
Conservation through cultivation. We want to have cultivated sources that people are growing American ginseng on their woodlots. But we also want to be able to have a national ginseng conservation plan that looks at protecting wild populations of genetic diversity throughout ginseng's range.
To that end, United Plant Savers is promoting a petition asking the Federal Department of Agriculture, the Forest Service, and the Fish and Wildlife Service to work to endorse better management practices, quote, that essentially mitigate climate change, enhance rural economies, and provide a sustainable source of wild medicinal plants for future generations, which has a strong cultural heritage throughout the Appalachian Range, close quote. In the meantime, folks like those at the 2014 Ginseng Summit are working to find ways to collaborate among themselves to develop and align best practices to sustain their agroforest business. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Meigs County, Ohio.
Food growers and producers can gain business from tourism, or at least that's the idea behind an increasingly popular movement to encourage food tourism. In Appalachia, food destinations are being promoted with a new culinary map created by the Appalachian Regional Commission. The premiere of this map was celebrated at an event yesterday at the Capital Market in Charleston. Roxy Todd reports.
Agrotourism is not a new concept to Tootie Jones, a fifth-generation farmer. She raises grass-fed beef on Swift Level Farm in Lewisburg. She was one of the farmers who attended yesterday's event at the Capital Market.
I sell beef all over West Virginia. We have about 14 restaurants now and several retail stores in Huntington and in Lewisburg.
Some of the stores and restaurants that sell her beef are featured on a new online map, which can be found at visitappalachia.com. There's also a print map, which lists 283 food destinations across the region. The map was distributed to tourism agencies and ran in a magazine called Food Traveler. Jones's Swift Level Farm is featured as a destination on the map.
We love having people of all ages come to the farm, and I have a lot of hands-on activities for children. They can feed the chickens and collect eggs and feed the pigs and run free in the grass and not worry about anything but having fun.
The movement to promote regional food could give farmers like Jones a boost by helping to establish their farms as tourist destinations. Yesterday's event also celebrated the work of farmers and chefs who have been behind the local food movement in West Virginia for some time.
My name is Dale Hawkins. I'm one of the owners of Fishhawk Acres in Rock Cave. We believe local food is important for the economy of West Virginia just because that it's going to keep that money in state as opposed to being sent out of state.
Fishhawk Acres is also featured on the Appalachian food map. At the event, Hawkins displayed local breads, homemade ranch mustard, and one of West Virginia's most iconic local foods, Pickens maple syrup. All of these local offerings could mean big things for West Virginia's food and tourism economies.
And on our farm, we actually are looking at agritourism as a business to actually bringing people to the farm and letting them connect with where their food comes from.
According to Mandala Research, nearly 80% of all leisure travelers list dining and other food activities as a top priority. As local food movements across the country begin to take root, and the term foodie has emerged in urban areas, Appalachian festivals, farms, and farm-to-table restaurants could benefit by promoting the region as a tourist destination. The Appalachian food map features businesses and events from 13 states, with events like a green bean festival in Georgia, a pawpaw festival in Ohio, and a liver mush festival in North Carolina. Although the Mountain State is known for its many festivals, only the East End Bazaar in Charleston is listed as an event on the printed map. Other events, like the West Virginia State Fair, are included on the online version, which has doubled the number of destinations compared to the printed map. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Roxy Todd in Charleston.
And for more information about the Appalachian Regional Commission's map, you can go to our website, wvpublic.org. This is West Virginia Morning. It's coming up on 7:43. Some fog this morning. Once it clears away, mostly sunny skies. Temperatures in the 70s today, clear overnight, with lows in the upper 40s and 50s. Continued mostly sunny on Thursday. Temperatures remaining in the 70s, with overnight lows in the 50s. The outlook for Friday and Saturday, partly cloudy, with a chance of rain and thunderstorms. Temperatures in the 70s and low 80s. In Pocahontas County, the week-long old-time music workshop Allegheny Echoes just wrapped up its 18th year last month. It's like a summer band camp for old-time musicians. And the Traveling 219 Project brought back some of the sounds and voices from this year's workshop. Dan Schultz reports.
For 1 week each June, Marlinton, West Virginia, lights up with the sound of fiddles and banjos. The week-long workshop, Allegheny Echoes, attracts nearly 150 students each year to the mountains of Pocahontas County to play and learn traditional West Virginia old-time music. The epicenter of Allegheny Echoes is the Marlinton Motor Inn, where classes are held and students are lodged for the week. Every night after the workshops, the students and instructors can let loose, and it's not uncommon for informal jam circles to last well into the night or the morning.
Yeah, Yeah, it usually starts picking up after 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. Typically on the Friday nights after the instructor concerts, it's not unusual to see a lot of the musicians play until like 3 or 4 in the morning.
That's Lee Klein. Lee's from Lynchburg, Virginia, and spent his 12th consecutive year this June at Allegheny Echoes. He's devoted different years to different instruments, including the banjo, fiddle, and vocals. It's also a family gathering for Lee. His brother Billy has been coming for 17 years.
And of course, my wife's up here. She takes vocal. She used to study the fiddle up here. We don't take a week off or anything else other than come up here. This is what we like to do.
I left the motor in parking lot at 11 p.m., just as the jam circles were really getting going. The next morning, I joined one of the Allegheny Echoes classes for an unexpected field trip.
So then, the rest of what we're going to do is...
My name is Jake Crack. I'm from Pocahontas County, West Virginia, and I'm teaching an advanced fiddle class this week. Our last day, I always take the class out for a little field trip, and so we're having class up at the Big Spruce Overlook here on Black Mountain. Kind of appreciate nature and learn our last tune and review everything we've done for the week.
Jake Crack is one of the country's most renowned young fiddle players. Jake's been winning competitions at the nation's top old-time festivals for over a decade now. Each morning at Allegheny Echoes, Jake instructs his class in advanced fiddle technique and teaches them a new tune.
The way I like to do it is I give everybody a couple, I'll play a couple tunes and let them choose, do you like this one better? Because my thought is when you're learning a tune, it's much easier if you enjoy the tune you're learning. So I give them an option and then I'll play it for them up to speed and I'll slow it down as slow as I can play it. And then we'll start breaking it out into phrases and we'll learn it a phrase at a time and then combine it all and then repeat it.
Although a majority of Jake's students are older than he is, a significant number of younger students are represented at Allegheny Echoes as well.
I'm Claire Massesso, 19. I'm from Pocahontas County, lived here my whole life. And I've been coming here for 6 years, I think.
I'm Christian Moore, and I'm 12, and this is my first year here, and I really am enjoying it. My favorite thing about Allegheny Echoes is just that learning how to get better at the fiddle, and it's just be able to play along with other people and everything.
Claire and Christian reflect the younger generation of musicians that Allegheny Echoes strives to include. Dozens of scholarships are awarded each year to young West Virginians who are interested in learning old-time music. Mike Bing plays mandolin in the Bing Brothers Band and helped found Allegheny Echoes back in 1997. Continuing the West Virginia tradition and style of old-time music is one of the missions of Allegheny Echoes.
I taught at a couple of the other music camps, and they were in West Virginia, but they didn't represent too much of West Virginia. But we mix it up and have some out-of-staters, but mostly we're West Virginia people doing West Virginia music.
This story was produced by Dan Schultz of the Traveling 219 Project, a production of Allegheny Mountain Radio, with support from the West Virginia Humanities Council, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and AmeriCorps Vista. To learn more about this story and hear more from the road, check out traveling219.com. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. We're interested in your comments. You can send them to feedback@wvpublic.org. Follow us on Twitter @WVPublicNews and find us on Facebook. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Ashton Mara. Our director is Teresa Wills. I'm Beth Voorhees.